This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello, my name's Dan. Thank you so much for listening. This is the show that answers all of the hugest and most amazing questions that our universe throws up. Today, we're talking about killer lakes. We'll learn more about electricity as well. We'll get an expert in the Fun Kids studio to answer one of the questions that you have sent to my page at funkidslive.com. And we've got quite a spacey start to the show, actually, right? In a sec, we are chatting to Dr. Maggie Adarin-Pocock. She is a space scientist. You might recognise her off of the telly. And we'll find out loads more about all the stars in the sky with her. First, we're joining Finley on our Geology Rocks series, learning about the creation of Earth.
Geology Rocks! Geological Society!
Hiya! Mum's got me cutting the grass! The lawn looks very neat now, even if I didn't say so myself. Oh, time for a rest, I think.
We don't think much about the ground beneath our feet. It's just something that we stand on, or what we're mowing. It's pretty weird to think that the ground is the surface of an enormous planet called Earth. Want to see how it all started? Come on, I'll show you. It starts with a bang. The Big Bang! Ooh. The Big Bang was the start of the universe as we know it, and that happened 13 billion years ago. Back then, the universe was very hot and squashed into a tiny space until it started to expand very quickly. Most scientists agree this is how our universe started, but no one was there. So how could they know? It's mainly because they can see that the universe is still expanding outwards, and they can measure the speed at which things are travelling. So basically, they can track these measurements back to one point in time. After the Big Bang, it would take several billion years before anything that looked like a planet would start to appear. This was because all that matter that was flying around had to join up. And that took a very long time. Let's leap forward a few billion years. 4.6 billion years ago. Whilst this is our solar system, there's no planets as we know them to see. No Saturn with its rings, and no red Mars. They're just a swirling mass of dust and gas. It looked more like a gigantic whirlpool. But at the centre of this whirlpool, a small star is beginning to form. That's our sun.
Wow! That was close!
We're on the edge of the solar system. The sun has used up more than 99% of all the material, leaving a few scraps for the planets to form using a process called accretion. This is where bits of stuff flying about stick together and make things bigger, like when you make a snowball. Oh, I think I need to get out of the way. What's really amazing is that most of the building blocks of these planets have come from supernovas. That's what happens when a star dies. It gets so hot and heavy, it explodes. A supernova is what we call a star explosion. It sends new elements out into the universe, which are slurped into the forming planets. Without supernovas, we wouldn't have gold, or silver, or iron, or copper, or two-thirds of the elements that make up our world. And here's a really cool thing. That means our bodies are made of the same supernova stuff too. So if you're having a bad day, just think, you really are a superstar. Let's see what Earth is looking like. Well, I don't think I'd like to live on Earth yet, but we'll find out more about that another time.
Geology Picks.
We humans think we're pretty cool, but we're really just the new kids on the block. If you imagine the Earth's history as a 12-hour clock face, we don't even appear until a few minutes before 12. Incredible! Time to go! see you again soon. In the meantime, find out more on the Fun Kids website.
Geology Rocks! The Geological Society!
You can get more Geology Rocks for free for your phone and tablet. Get to iTunes, get to the Fun Kids app, and have a look at funkidslive.com. Now, do you know what Orion, Andromeda, Polaris, and the Plough are? Rack your brains for a second. If you do, right, do me a favour. Keep it to yourself. Keep shtum for a little bit, because a space expert will be on the show in a sec and she'll tell us loads more about what you can see every single night in the sky. Before that, I need to say a massive thank you to you if you've said something nice about this show on the iTunes podcast store, because loads of you have and I'm loving reading them. It makes me very happy before I go to sleep every night. All you need to do, right, if you are enjoying the show and you want to let everyone else know how much you loving it, that you're learning loads of things about the world, about nature, about all the dangerous stuff involved too, just get out your phone or your tablet, open up the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. Write some words, let us know your name as well so I know who you are. Also, drop us some stars. If I see it and if I know that you're loving it, next week I might say hello to you. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We've got a big guest on the show this week. She's the presenter of The Sky at Night on the BBC. She is a space scientist as well. She's helped put out a brand new book. It's called Starfinder for Beginners. Dr. Maggie Adarin Pocock, MBE. Hello, welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you, it's lovely to be here.
Well, brilliant. I'm so pleased that you're here with us because I'm fascinated by stars. And I just sometimes think they're too big, too out of Earth for any one person to really understand fully.
It's true, they are ginormous. You can fit a million Earths into one star, one sun. So our local star is the sun, and we're sort of quite used to that. You know, we get warmed by the sun, UV radiation comes from the sun, tans our skin. So that is our local star. But in our galaxy, there are about 300 billion stars. So it's quite mind-boggling stuff.
And are all the other stars out there, do they act like a sun to other planets, or are they just random ones flying about?
So they are part of a huge galaxy called the Milky Way, which is our galaxy. And so we're one of these 300 billion stars. And the really exciting thing is, over the last 20 years, we have been finding planets going around these stars. We call them exoplanets. And it's a hot topic in astronomy at the moment, because we're looking at these exoplanets and, of course, looking for life.
So what's the difference between an exoplanet and a planet?
Well, our local planets, you know, Mercury, Venus, or that lot, those are our planets. Those are the things we're used to. Exoplanet means sort of around another star. So exoplanets go around other stars, but the planets just go around our star. So our sun is the local star. Planets go around our sun, but exoplanets go around other stars. And with 300 billion out there, there's lots of exoplanets.
I guess the first question, it has to be the most obvious one. What is an actual star? What's it made out of? Why is it there?
So a star is a very, very large body. As I said, you fit a million Earths into one sun. So our sun is a local star. And it's effectively when you get a sort of a solar systems. And when they form, you get sort of just matter, you know, swimming around. And slowly but surely, due to gravity, things start clumping together. Now, if you get lots and lots of matter clumping together in the centre, it sort of clumps together so much that it actually starts a process called fusion. Now, fusion is an amazing reaction, a chemical reaction, where you take hydrogen, you put two hydrogen atoms together and you get helium. Now, when you do this, you get huge amounts of energy, which is why stars shine brightly. So this whole chemical process is happening in the centre of the star. The star starts to shine bright. It gives out all sorts of radiation. It gives out visible light. It gives out UV. It gives out infrared energy. It gives out all this energy. And so it's like a powerhouse. So you've got this chemical reaction taking place in the centre, but also because it's so huge, it's got so much mass, it's trying to suck in on itself as well. So there's a very careful balance between the energy being generated in the inside, pushing outwards, and then the gravity pushing inwards.
So this sounds really naive. The light that comes from a star, it's not fire. It's not something burning. It's just a lot happening inside it.
Well, it is, see, because when we actually sort of set things on fire, if I had a match here and I struck it and it caught on fire, then it will burn, it would give out light because of a chemical reaction. There's a chemical reaction taking place in a star, but it's a very different type of chemical reaction. Fusion is the stuff that is sort of on a very fundamental level. So sort of atoms smashing together, they sort of form new elements, and they also give out lots of light. So it's not the stars burning, but it's this fusion process that's taking place.
And how long does your standard average star tend to last? What's their life cycle?
Yeah, so quite surprisingly, stars do have life cycles. And so our sun is a million times the size of Earth, quite large. And it was sort of born in out of this cloud that I mentioned earlier. And it sort of, yeah, sat together. It started to sort of burning. It started this fusion reaction. But as it gets older, it will run out of fuel. I mentioned that balance between the gravity pushing inwards and the fusion taking place outwards. Eventually it will run out of fuel, so the fusion will stop and then gravity will suck it in. And then eventually what will happen to our star is it will actually sort of slowly but surely get fatter and fatter and fatter, and it will actually start gobbling up planets. So it will gobble up Mercury, it will gobble up Venus, and eventually it will gobble up Earth. Now, we don't need to panic. None of this is happening for about 4.5 billion years. So we've got a bit of time to plan. but there are other stars which are bigger than our sun. And they die in a spectacular manner because they go supernova. And what happens is a similar reaction happens. So gravity's pushing inwards. They run out of fuel. But because they're so large and got so much gravity, they sort of suck in and then blow outwards, sending matter into space. And the fact is that we are actually matter from stars. We are stardust. Because when that matter is blown out into space, that's what the chemicals that make us and the table and everything else on Earth. But then we are the product of stardust.
I just feel like I need to leave it to be silent a bit.
Yes, a moment's hush.
Stardust. What's the whole deal? Because I know that there's millions and millions of light years between stars. When we're looking up at the sky, we see constellations, maybe like the Plough. They're really, really, really far apart from each other. Does that mean that occasionally when we look into the sky and we see stars, we're actually looking backwards in time?
See, now, you mentioned this light year. A light year is an interesting concept because it isn't actually a concept of time. It's a concept of distance. So a light year is actually the distance that light will travel in a year. So it's a pretty big distance. Now, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to do the conversion, but I can't think of it. But it is a long, long, long... We're talking about billions and billions of miles. So, now, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. That's one of the things that Einstein said. So when you look at a star, if it is, let's say, our next-door neighbour star is 4.25 light years away. It's called Proxima Centauri. 4.25 light years away. And so when light leaves that star, it takes 4.25 years to reach us. So if Proxima Centauri blew up, we wouldn't know about it for 4.5 years. Because even travelling at the speed of light, nothing can travel faster than that. It would take 4.5 years for that light to get to us.
What tends to be the furthest star away that we can see visibly in the night sky?
Whoa. Okay, so if we use telescopes, I mentioned our galaxy, the Milky Way, 300 billion stars. We can see other galaxies. Andromeda is a local galaxy. We can go further and further out. We can see almost back to the beginning of the universe. So we can actually sort of see light years, many, many light years into the past. And what we're actually watching is galaxies that no longer exist, because it's taken sort of billions of years for their light to get to us. The galaxy may no longer exist, but we're only just receiving the light now.
So the universe is constantly expanding. Does that mean if we look farther enough out into the distance, we can actually see the edge of the known universe?
Now, the edge of the universe is an interesting concept. Because as scientists, we've actually been pondering what the universe, how it works, what the universe is. We believe the universe began with a big bang. And we think that because when you look out with sort of telescopes and use sort of instruments to analyse the starlight, you can see that everything seems to be moving away from us. It's as if you've got a balloon with stars on it, and then as you blow up the balloon, the stars move further and further away, the galaxies move further and further away.
So the whole thing is expanding rather than just...
Yes.
The perimeter getting a bit bigger.
Yes, so the whole thing is expanding. So we can zoom back in time about, yeah, 4.5 billion years, and to actually say 14.5 billion years, to see that everything started as a point. And we know it's expanding outwards, but we don't know what it's expanding outwards into. But there's all sorts of wonderful ideas, like a multiverse. We're not the only universe out there. There's many different universes all sort of thriving at the same time. So we're going into the realm of mind-boggling stuff, but yeah, that's what's out there.
I want to talk about what we can actually see right now in the night sky. So the book is Starfinder for Beginners, and it's a beautiful book all about the constellations, the galaxies that we can see with a bit of investigation into the night sky. Now, how did constellations come to be, and how did old age travellers use them to navigate around the globe?
So constellations, if you look across the globe, there's an area of astronomy called archaeoastronomy, and it's like archaeology for astronomy. And if you look at different cultures across the world, every culture has looked up and thought, what's going on out there? And it's a fundamental question. And so some people thought, okay, we don't quite understand what's going on, but that, you know, actually they were doing dots to dots in the sky. They said, that looks a bit like a guy, or that looks like a plough. And they started actually doing dots to dots into the sky. And they came up with stories behind those dots to dots. So you know, there's Orion, the hunter, and he's got, you know, a bull's head in his hand and things like that. So they came up with all these ideas. So, but as well as that, for instance, here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're really, really lucky. Because if you look sort of towards the north, there's something called the Pole Star, or the North Star. Now, if you take a photograph and point your camera at the Pole Star and leave your camera open for a long time, you'll see that all the other stars in the night sky swirl around that North Star, the Pole Star. So if you're sort of if you can find the Pole Star, the North Star, and you're a bit lost, you know which direction north is, so you can use it for navigation. So sort of ideas like this has come up, and people have used other sort of constellations for navigation and things like that. Now, in the Southern Hemisphere, they don't have a sort of a nice bright star at the pole, but you can still use the stars for navigation. But the constellation sort of came up because we really didn't know what was going on out there. And so they said, yeah, it looks a bit like a plough. Yeah, it's plough. Let's go for that.
So the Pole Star is Polaris, isn't it?
Polaris,
can
yes.
you tell me a bit more about this? What do we know about the actual star? Because ever since we're young, we're told to look to the North Star. And I think everyone gets it wrong as well. Everyone thinks the North Star is the North Star when it's really a plane that's just a bit bright.
Yes. Can you tell us... flashing, it's not a star.
Can you tell us anything more about Polaris and how the best way to find it
yes.
when we look up at the sky?
Lovely. Now, many people think that Polaris, the North Star, is the brightest star in the sky. Unfortunately, that's not the case. It's Sirius, the dog star, which doesn't actually point you north. So now, if you want to find the Pole Star, you need to do some star hopping. So, and now in the night sky, there's so many different stars. But if you home in, there are a few fairly familiar ones. One of my favourites is Orion, and another one is the Plough that you mentioned. If you look at the plough is made up of seven stars. And so it's got a sort of, you know, the handle and then the sort of the bowly bit. And now if you take the end of the bowly bit, you've got two stars there. You can use those two stars to point your way to the Pole Star, to the North Star. So this is what effectively we're doing in star hopping. We're using something familiar and using it as a guide to find other stars which might not be quite so bright or might not be quite so visible in the night sky. But we can actually use it to star hop and find the North Star that way.
What is the first recorded a writing or drawing, I guess, in old times, of a constellation that we have? What do you reckon the first one that age-old travellers saw when they looked up?
Yes. So most of the constellations that we sort of are familiar with today, you know, Orion, the Hunter, the Plough, things like that, most of these were sort of a Greek-Roman. So we're going back quite a few thousand years. But it's interesting because in the Northern Hemisphere, we're used to sort of the constellations and things like that. But if you go to the Southern Hemisphere, again, people looked up at the night sky there. But if you're actually in the Southern Hemisphere, you're looking into the heart of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And if you look into the heart of the Milky Way, I've been to the Southern Hemisphere a number of times and whoa, there are so many stars. And so people like the Aboriginals, when they looked out, they didn't actually come up with constellations because it's like doing a dot to dot with too many dots. What they did is they saw little clouds of dust where light wasn't coming through. And they looked at these clouds of dust and said, okay, yeah, that looks like an emu. And that look. So they didn't use stars as constellations. They used clouds of dust in our Milky Way galaxy as constellations instead because there are so many stars. So I think, again, it's this thing. And when we do stargazing, we're going back to an age-old tradition that, you know, our forefathers, our grandmothers and everybody else has done for many thousands of years, looking up and seeing the wonders of the night sky.
If I were to look up tonight into the sky and see a few stars dotted around that I thought looked like a chicken or something, is there somewhere I could go to name that a constellation? Like, could I call up NASA or maybe the European Space Agency and say, I've just seen a chicken up there, I want it to be called, I don't know, the chicken, I guess. I couldn't think of something.
Another?
I couldn't think of anything more imaginative there.
I think a chicken would be pretty good. But the problem is, most of the constellations, these are traditional. So as I said, you know, the Greeks, the Romans, they came up with these constellations and they've been carried down forth. And if you came up with a constellation called the Chicken, it would probably use stars, which are already in other constellations. And otherwise, other people would always be coming up and saying, oh, look, there's a chicken. Oh, no, that's I think that's more of a chair over there. And so we stick with the constellations that we've actually inherited from our past. So we don't come up with new constellations, but there are new things to find in the night sky. Because we're talking about constellations which are made out of sort of different stars. there were sort of planets, and people find new comets and asteroids and things like that. And so they get, you can actually get to name something if you find, discover something new. But I think your chicken constellation would probably be made out of stars, which have already been, you know, allocated to other constellations. So I don't think NASA would give you that.
You mentioned asteroids just a second ago. Kind of finally, talk us through an asteroid. What is that in relation to stars? What are shooting stars? How do they all work together?
There's a lot of stuff out there and a lot of brilliant stuff to see. So we're starting off with our stars and our constellations, and we can move around the night sky with those. Then as well as that, there are planets. So we mentioned planets sort of going around our sun. So because they're in orbit around our sun, if we are one side of the sun and the planet is the other side of the sun, we won't see them because they'll be invisible because the sun's so bright. But if they're our side of the solar system, then we can see them. So I think at the moment you can probably see Venus. Venus is beautiful. The morning star or the evening star. So you see either at sunrise or sunset. So you can sort of pick that up. Jupiter, Mars, all these planets are visible at certain times of the year. So those are okay. So we've got stars, we've got planets. Now, next, if I go to asteroids. Asteroids are just sort of large lumps of rock, maybe up to sort of a kilometre or so in size, which sort of also orbit around the sun. Sometimes they get sort of knocked out of position and they might get closer to Earth. You know, people don't want near-Earth asteroids and get really freaked out, but we're keeping a constant watch to see, you know, if there's anything coming near Earth, and so usually it just burns up on the atmosphere, so we're pretty safe in that respect. Okay, shooting stars. Total misnomer.
Right.
They're not stars at all. Shooting stars are actually sort of often just sort of a tiny bits of rock, which as they are sort of usually left behind by a comet. Let's do a comet first. A comet is again a lump of rock and ice which travels around the sun, and they actually have an orbit which is quite a squashed circle. It's called an ellipse, and so they go a long, long way from the sun, and then they come in closer to the sun. And when they come in closer to the sun, they heat up and they leave a trail, a blazing tail, which is beautiful to see if you can get to see one. So that's a comet. But now, when it sort of as it travels round and round the sun in this sort of elliptical orbit, it leaves a trail of dust and sort of particles behind it. Now, if the Earth travels through that trail of dust and gas and particles, those little particles hit the Earth's atmosphere at great speed and burn up. And that's how you get a shooting star. It's just a grain of dust burning up on the Earth's atmosphere.
So a tiny grain of dust as well, really?
Yeah, so the things that they're burning really bright. Sometimes so you can get sort of a meteorite which fall to Earth, and they can be a bit bigger. And you can actually get meteorites that take out the dinosaurs. So they can get pretty large. But most of the stuff we see as shooting stars are just tiny bits of dust burning up on the Earth's atmosphere.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for blowing everyone's mind. On the Fun Kids Science Weekly. The book is Starfinder for Beginners. If you've ever looked at the night sky and kind of wondered what's out there, wondered why everyone's seeing pictures that you're not, you need to pick it up. Dr. Maggie Adderin-Pocock, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, thank you.
We will do our Dangerous Dan in just a sec, having a look this week at killer lakes. Sounds amazing, stay right there. First, we're checking in with Harry and Terry. They are our space cadets. You know about all these, right? These two mates? If you don't, very quickly, it's a long story. They were queuing up for a hot dog one day. Boom, out of nowhere, they got sucked up into space. Now they're flying about all over the place, spending their time as the space cadets, having adventures through the universe. But they must be hungry, because they still haven't got the hot dog. Today, they're checking out Mercury.
Welcome along to the astro adventures of the space cadets.
Okay, your go. Let's go, Top Hat. Land on Houston. Land on Houston. Land on... Oh, waterworks.
Oh, no. Are you boys trying to play Monopoly again? You know it all flies everywhere out here in space.
No, it's okay, Zingy. We've sorted it. We've stuck it down with BlueTac.
But where'd you get that from?
From my pack.
Right.
Where are we anyway, Zingy? Are we heading home now?
Oh, no, boys. Not yet. There's still so much of our solar system to explore. Today, Mission Control are sending us to investigate the planet Mercury.
Sounds cool.
It's actually rather warm. See, Mercury is the closest planet to the Sun in our entire solar system. Daytime temperatures can reach up to 427 degrees.
But I meant... never mind.
However, there are polar craters on Mercury, which, due to their position on the planet, are never warmed by the Sun. They can reach temperatures as cold as minus 183 degrees. I guess that's what you meant.
Yeah, sure it was.
You can see them for yourself. Mercury's surface is covered in craters. They're impact craters from comets and asteroids bombarding the planet's surface billions of years ago.
I can't see anything.
Well, open your curtains then, and you'll probably get an even better view if you get up off the bed.
Oh yeah, looks really battered and small. Can't be much to investigate.
Mercury is indeed the smallest planet in our solar system. Only the dwarf planets are smaller. Mercury is about the third of the size of Earth, and because it's so close to the Sun, it completes an orbit every 88 days. That's a very short year.
So what? A day's a day, isn't it?
Well, no, actually. Mercury spins extremely slowly, much slower than Earth. So a day on Mercury lasts for 59 Earth days.
Wicked. Think how long break time at school would last.
Yeah, although I think how long maths would take.
Oh, yeah, good point. Hey, Zingy, if that's true, doesn't it mean there's less than 2 days in an entire year on Mercury?
That's right. Each planet has different length days and years depending on its position and velocity in our solar system.
I love Mercury. Oh, I wish it could be Christmas every other day.
As a computer, I'm not too familiar with this concept of singing, but I'm not sure I like it.
Don't worry, Zingy. That wasn't singing.
Anyway, are we stopping off for lunch at this tiny planet or what?
I'm afraid not, Harry. See, we can't actually land on Mercury and get out.
Why not? RoboWolf wants a wee.
For the last time, robots, dog or otherwise, do not wee. Stop blaming RoboWolf for your mishaps.
Zingy has got a point, dude. It's getting ridiculous. If you need a hand pouring the apple juice, just ask. We've almost run out.
It's far too dangerous to land and get out. Firstly, we can't risk the extreme temperatures. My old spaceship, the Inflammable, proved that. Also, there's no atmosphere surrounding the planet, so there's no gaseous environment to help sustain life. Unlike on Earth, where our atmosphere provides the oxygen we need to breathe.
Wow, no atmosphere. Just like one of my Uncle Norman's parties, then.
Anyway, the largest known impact crater on Mercury is called the Caloris Basin. I've positioned the ship directly above it, see?
Wow, that's one pretty big hole.
From the measurements the ship is taking now, we can see the Caloris Basin has a diameter of 960 miles.
Wow, mate, that's one very big hole.
We shall fly around the planet again and scan for larger craters and report back to Mission Control.
Don't bother. Nothing's going to beat that hole.
Impact crater. Yes, it is one of the largest known impact craters in the entire solar system.
Hey, Zingy, do you know why my compass has gone all funny? I just got it out of my pack and it's going haywire.
Well, Mercury has an iron core, like Earth, so it has a magnetic field. That will affect your compass. But why do you even have a compass?
I was hoping to take Harry space orienteering. We've not been allowed to go orienteering with the school anymore. Not after last time on that farm.
I was only borrowing the tractor to speed us up a bit.
They never did find all those sheep.
Ah, I see.
So, there's the Sun, our nearest star, then there's Mercury and Venus and the Earth. But you keep saying there's 8 planets in our solar system. What are the others?
Well, starting from the Sun, the order of the planets in our solar system is Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune.
Whoa, I'll never remember them all in order.
I think I've forgotten them already.
Okay, well why don't you try a mnemonic?
A moronic?
No, a mnemonic. It's where you replace each planet with a word starting with the same letter, forming a sentence to help you remember. For example, my very exciting mission just secured unforgettable names. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Simple.
Nice one.
Yeah, that's great. We'll remember them now.
So where are we off to next, Zingy?
Well, I'll fire off those details about Mercury and its craters. Next up, we're going to take a look at Venus. Setting coordinates.
My very Venus. Hey, that's the next planet in line.
Let's go.
Join us next time for more Astro Adventures with the Space Cadets.
Yeah, and you can download all of their episodes for free for your phone and tablet. Get to iTunes, get to the Fun Kids app, and have a look at funkidslive.com. Right, it's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we are headed to Africa to have a look at some killer lakes. Now, the thing is, it's not the water in these killer lakes that's the problem. It's not even the creatures in there that's out to get you. It's the gas that's sitting underneath it. Because lakes Nyos and Kivu, they both sit on areas of volcanic activity, and they're prone to something called limnic eruptions. Now, this is where carbon dioxide, right, you know carbon dioxide, you breathe it out every day. It's all around you, but it's a dangerously strong gas when there's loads of it about. And in these eruptions, it bursts out from the bottom of the lake. It turns the water a reddish-brown colour. And this gas, it surges into the air to form a cloud. But it's too heavy. It sinks through the air, slowly coming back down to Earth. And it's huge. It's made of carbon dioxide. It forces all the oxygen away. And you need oxygen to breathe. But there's none left. It's all carbon dioxide. It's not a good thing. So slowly, this gas cloud, it covers everything nearby and it suffocates it all. And this is so sad. Thousands of people have died in this tragic way. These limnic eruptions, these killer lakes, they have absolutely earned their place on our Dangerous Dan list. You may have seen in the news this week, loads of people have been given Nobel Prizes for their work in science. They get a nice trophy as well. Loads of cash to share too. We'll find out more about that in just a sec. First, let's get one of your science questions answered by our expert, Tom. We do this every week, and I always say you need to remember no question is too silly or stupid. As long as it's about science, I don't really mind. It could be about why some animals have feet and others have hooves. Maybe it's about why your feet sometimes absolutely reek of cheese. Really doesn't matter. If it's about science, send it to my page at funkidslive.com and we'll try and get our expert Tom to answer it. Today's question comes from Sophie, who is 12, and she asks Tom, to create a metal oxide, what does metal have to react with?
In a metal oxide, the metal reacts with oxygen. Now, that's for an oxide. You could also have a dioxide, such as carbon dioxide. So why is that different? Well, for a metal oxide, the metal atom only reacts with one oxygen atom. So the molecule has one metal and one oxygen. Well, it could have more than one metal, but one oxygen. So carbon dioxide, it has one carbon atom and two oxygen atoms.
So we've got oxide, Tom. Are there any other elements in the world react with to make different substances and compounds?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, most things can react with each other. You could have a nitride from nitrogen, although nitrogen is fairly inert, so there aren't too many of these. You could have a chloride, and there's lots of chloride. Sodium chloride is table salt.
Why do some elements react much better than other elements? If you say nitrogen doesn't, but chlorine does, what's going on there?
It's to do with the structure of the atom. So you have a nucleus, which is protons and neutrons. These are slightly bigger, and then electrons around the outside. Now, these electrons move around the outside, and there's different number of electrons in each ring. So in much the same way the planets go round the sun, these electrons go round the atom in slightly different paths. So it depends on how many electrons are in that outer path.
And how many electrons is each path allowed to have?
So in the first path or ring, you're allowed 2 electrons. And then if there's a third electron, it would have to go outside of that. And there's 8 electrons allowed in the second ring. And if you had 2, then 8. So in the 11th electron would have to go in the third ring. Now, metals react quite well and, in fact, conduct electricity because they have a free electron in that outer ring, which can move about, and that's how you transmit electricity through it.
Time to look at what sciencey things have been in the news this week, then. The 2017 Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to 3 scientists who have improved the pictures that we can take of molecules. Now, molecules make up pretty much everything in the world, right? They are the building blocks of life as we know it. And these 3 scientists, they've come up with a process called cryo-electron microscopy, and it makes it easier to look at these molecules. Well done for them. Also, scientists have detected hundreds of Japanese marine species washed ashore in America due to a deadly tsunami in Asia. Now, this gigantic wave, it swept across Japan in 2011, sweeping up everything in its way. Loads of debris from the tsunami, you know, like specific Japanese mussels, starfish, and indigenous marine creatures. They've gone all the way to America, been washed up there, forced to get a new home in the States. And finally, a new species of giant rat has been found in the Solomon Isles. The rodent, which is native to these group of islands in the Pacific Ocean, they are 4 times the size of regular rats, and they can stretch to 0.5 meter in length. They live among the trees, they survive on big nuts, and it is the first new discovery of rat on the island for 80 years, which is exciting, but I still won't be going there. Right, it's time to talk electricity now with our abandoned alien friends N and G, because they're trying to find a way to power up their spaceship to get home, and today they're going inside your home.
N and G's Energy Challenge.
The human electricity is brilliant.
Well, I can see that. You're so
certainly making the most of it.
Look, I've got the telebox on, and the computer, and popcorn's ready.
Made a snack too. Look, come on, we're not going to find our way back to Zog sitting here. Let's find out more about electricity, like how it gets into these houses. I think we might need to go underground for this.
Aww, can't I just finish watching the telly? Just 5 more minutes. All of the gadgets that you've been using get their energy through plugs that you've connected to sockets in the wall. Electricity is fed through these sockets, through cables under the floorboards or within the walls. And in turn, these cables connect up to even bigger cables under the streets. And there's nearly 14,000 kilometres of them.
Ouch! We hit a substation. Inside these buildings is equipment that changes the voltage of the electricity so that it's suitable to be used within homes.
Is this where electricity's made?
Nope, our journey isn't over yet.
Ooh, big metal trees!
Pylons, they're called pylons. The UK has over 7,000 kilometres of overhead wires carried between pylons. These power lines crisscross the country, carrying electricity to where it's needed. And it isn't just homes. Electricity powers trains and factories, schools and streetlights, and it all comes from here, back to where it started.
Where's that? The power station? Is this where electricity is made?
Yep, there's over 50 power stations across the UK. They're often found in the countryside or near the coast, normally far away from where people live. Electricity that's made here is a bit like a stream of tiny charged particles that are fed into those cables. Just think of it as a massive river running around the country.
Oh, wow. And the cables carry the electricity all the way to people's homes.
You've got it. If somebody wants to use some electricity, they just take it out of the flow at the plug sockets.
N, Mrs. Mubcombe and Harrow just switched her kettle on.
Why is that a problem?
Well, it's a flow going around the country and she's got it going into her kettle. Everyone else will have to wait for their electricity. Hurry up with your copper, Mrs. Mubcombe.
That's not how it works. Electricity travels in an enormous loop. Some electricity will go into the kettle, but the rest just keeps going around the country until it's either used or returns to the power station. And then it all starts again.
As endless as the flowing lava over the most southerly Zogian snowcaps.
Kinda. It's got something in common with the lava flows on Zog, actually.
You mean the electricity comes bursting out of the top of the crag of Mount Oob?
Well, clearly not.
I suppose that would be a bit hard with Mount Oob being on Zog, 3 trillion light years away. Is it that the flow of electricity races down the ice pig plains on the 7th moon day of the equinox?
You're obsessed with those ice pigs. And no, what I meant was the circuit of electricity can be very dangerous. It can even kill humans. You'll have noticed the big signs warning of the danger near overhead lines and around substations.
Well, however great this electricity is, there's no danger of it getting us home. Our laser pod needs something even more powerful.
You may be right. We'll have to keep searching. Watch out! Looks like we're gonna fuse, G!
Here it comes! Whoopee! I love a bit of fusion!
Here it comes! Woohoo!
NMG's Energy Challenge, with support from National Grid. Find out more online at funkislive.com/energy.
You can get all our Energy episodes for free. Get on your phone or tablet, get to iTunes, the Fun Kids app, and as always, it's over at funkidslive.com. Right, that is it for our episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, we are back next week with more answers to the most baffling, ridiculous and amazing questions that the universe has to offer. You can get all of our science series as well for free on iTunes, over at funkidslive.com, and also on your phone and tablet on the free Fun Kids app. And while you're on the app, it's a brilliant way that you can hear Fun Kids all over the country. You can get it there. You can also get it on your DAB digital radio and tune in online at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.